This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Ricky Cobb will be with us at the bottom of the hour, host of the Ricky Cobb Show, brand new on Outkick.com, big sports guy. Michael Allen, 10 minutes, former special assistant to President Trump, senior director at the National Security Council, and staff director of the House Intel Committee. So Michael Allen will bring us up to date on Vladimir Putin's latest threats to start a nuclear war. What else is new? Also, major military war games with China and Russia working together, the biggest one in 50 years. So this is all noteworthy stuff, and that's just two of the big stories. But right now, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We will hold social media platforms accountable. If you act as a megaphone for misinformation, we are going to hold you accountable.
Isn't that interesting? Freedom of speech on the ballot as more social media crackdowns from countries and elsewhere, and allegations of bias continue to rage with just until we get the results, as we wait for the results of the election in November. You wonder what we're heading to. Where does this whole thing stand when it comes to the tech giants? We'll talk about it.
Number two.
What we are is a city that only wants our safety, security, and sovereignty back. We've had total upheaval because of it. Our food pantries, they get stripped. Our emergency rooms are overrun.
There you go. That is Mark Sanders, a resident in Springfield, Ohio. Overrun with illegal immigrants. The border's broken. First, it was just punishing border towns. Now, under Harris and Biden, no small and big city through America is escaping unscathed. This might just decide the election.
Number one.
We will end all taxes on overtime.
The people who work overtime are among the hardest working citizens in our country. And for too long, no one in Washington has been looking out for them.
Donald Trump weighing in with another new program, 53 days and no more debates, and seven states. It's going to be all about those seven battleground states. What can we expect from Trump and Harris? Battling it out, because there will be no more debates to go for head to head. We'll talk about it as they both battle to get, I don't know, working class votes, which is pretty much belongs to Donald Trump. That was Hass. So feeling good about the debates. I don't really, a couple of days since those big debates, I think a few things. Number one, it's just so obvious, the more you even look at it, as moderators are speaking out, the ABC moderators speaking out, they were determined to fact check Trump. In fact, they were quoted as saying they watched the last debate back and they said that Donald Trump said things that they thought were incorrect and they thought it was really bad. So Joe Biden's out, so we're going to make sure to correct. But why was Kamala Harris never corrected? Why was she never pressed on any of her positions? On what planet do you think it's not a big deal that the presidential candidate, without a primary process to screen her, should not be challenged on her change in positions that she hasn't even formally announced? So the more you think about it, there's really been nothing disclosed or learned from the debate. So you got to say, I think Harris definitely overperformed. I think Trump pretty much performed as usual, a little bit underperformed. But in the end, what do we know about the person we're going to elect? Now, the people that are going to vote for Trump are very decided. The people that are going to vote for Harris, anybody but Trump, are very decided. But there's just thousands in these battleground states that will ultimately decide who wins the election. But I think there's a frustration to somebody who legitimately can't decide, who sees the numbers, everything in the economy, from the credit card debt to the price of gas, your utilities, to the growth, the inflation up 26%. There's a sense that we can't continue. But then you got this, we can't continue like this. But then you have the vice president saying, I'm the candidate of change, a new generation. Upon further review, you're the same candidate that you said you're a team with Joe Biden. So how can you be different? So I watched Kevin O'Leary last night, and I thought, it's interesting. We didn't get any answers. And it's just about, just tell me who's going to bring the country in a way that's going to benefit me and my family. Cut 14.
Now, let's just talk about one policy I'm gravely concerned about. Taxing uncapitalized gains, which destroys capital formation. The reason people come here and why they invest here is to deploy their capital. Now, I got to know what that's about. Is that even a realistic idea? I can't believe that, because that would basically decimate the American dream. So if that's a reality, if that's a real policy, and I wish somebody would ask both candidates what their plans are on taxation, because a 28% corporate tax rate in the addition to state taxes would make America very uncompetitive in the G20. And we'd start losing companies like we did when the taxes were that high. They all went to Ireland, particularly the pharma companies.
And I think Ireland's corporate tax rate's in the teens. So that's why people moved. So when Donald Trump's tax cuts, if he does not win, they're going to evaporate. And that means this tax hike is going to go from back from 21 to 35%. It's going to rock the economy. It's absolutely going to affect your wallet. People know that the tax reform of 2018 was not just for the rich. They pumped that out because Donald Trump is rich, but he's not going for the rich. The rich aren't going for him. The working class are going for him. They always underperform too, and they underpoll the white working class. And it's firmly in his column where Trump is making great progress is Hispanics. And I don't think anyone's ready for that. So I don't think it's worth it going poll to poll. We're still waiting about a week to see what kind of effect this the debate had. But and I think it'll be I think Donald Trump, Joe Biden lost 2 points. He had the worst debate in the history of debates and he lost 2 points. Not only was he bad, but he lost his mind. He couldn't think, he couldn't talk, and he still only lost 2 points. I don't think Donald Trump's losing anything. But they're asking for another debate for a reason that Kamala Harris thinks she needs it, obviously. So a couple of things on the moderators. Get this. And this is a fact. This is the LA Times writes, with co-moderator David Muir, Davis was, this is Lindsay Davis, has studied hours of campaign rallies of Donald Trump and interviews to prepare for the much anticipated debate. And they were ready to counter the candidate's most egregious statements. Lindsay Davis went on to say this. She wanted to hold Trump's feet to the fire. And that's how she became ABC's rising star. Really? She's also, by the way, a co-member, Lindsay Davis was, of the same sorority, top sorority that Kamala Harris is on. So I'm in the beginning just say they did a good or bad or good job. But so it's so obvious they were biased. Mark Penn came out and said on our show it was the worst moderated debate he has seen in his entire life, and he's worked directly with two Clinton campaigns and one Hillary Clinton campaign, and has done pollsters and been a pundit and a pollster to this day. He's never seen it like this. Now, I know you don't want to blame the refs of the field when you lose a game. You don't want to say, well, I'm injured, that's why you beat me. I get it. I've subscribed to that. But it's noteworthy for me on the outside just to say, why is it that we talked about 2020, but we never talked about really inflation? Why is it that we never talked about our flip-flops? We talked about what Donald Trump said on that black journalist stage that night about Kamala Harris being black or Indian or whatever it was. Why is it that we're talking about January 6th again? Why were they not talking about immigration, those small towns? Trump made a mistake by talking about dogs and cats instead of saying that town's been overrun. And the town of Springfield, Ohio. Now, Ohio is not so much a battleground state these days, although there's a huge Senate race. If I'm Bernie Moreno, I'm living in Springfield, and I'm trying to solve that problem. They send National Guard in there because they got 15,000 Haitians that have come in, basically moving up the population by 25%. In immigration, too, there's another town that they found. Hard to pronounce. I hope I get this right. Charlieo, Pennsylvania. It's a small town. It's now up 2,000% in population because they decided without telling, not that there would have been pushback, telling the mayor and telling the governor, they were going to send import Haitian immigrants to you. Really? So the small town will have a population of 4,200 before 2022. They suddenly get a huge influx of Haitian immigrants. School districts across the county are right in the Pittsburgh area are finding themselves on the front lines of the migrant crisis. Laurel Highlands. Lauren Highlands, this other woman there, this family in this district, have seen an influx of immigrant students that don't speak English. How about 172? Really? The school district has seen an overwhelming influx of migrants that have created many challenges, including having to teach someone who find somebody who speaks French to learn English. We don't really have many French teachers out there in grammar schools, but we need them. Now they're calling up to the state of Ohio for help. And the state of Ohio is calling the federal government for help. And that's what Martha McCallum talked to you yesterday. You know, said, wait a second, you're a Republican governor. You had no heads up that these Haitian migrants were coming to you. Your cities have been overwhelmed. Your towns have been doubled. Also, they get driver's license. So they don't know how to drive. If you're over 18, you don't require any driving instruction. So you put a Haitian migrant used to driving with European rules, and you put them in roads they're not familiar with, and then you give them a car, and now you get in a ton of car accidents. So the combination that we're just discussing is the reason why I believe that that border wall, that border, thousands of miles away, could very well be the linchpin that decides who becomes the next president in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Ohio, in North Carolina. So I'm just fascinated by what's going on and how these small towns are affected. At first, it was just about New York and 67,000 illegals. I did not realize they were also putting them into these small towns. When we come back, Michael Allen, after that, Ricky Cobb, and then we take your phone calls, 1-866-408-7669.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Donald Trump undermined the Afghanistan government. He cut them completely out of the negotiations. He just worked with the Taliban.
Cut them out. To the degree where the former Central Command commander, General McKenzie, testified that there was a really pernicious effect of this Doha agreement, this withdrawal agreement that Mr. Trump put in place on the Afghan National Security Forces, as well as the Afghan government. So when the president came into office, this is what he inherited.
I cannot believe the biggest disaster in American history, pioneered by Joe Biden, against the wishes of his generals, has Admiral Kirby covering for him by looking back at the Doha agreement. I don't think that was a great agreement. I would never have kept the Afghan government out, but the Taliban would not talk unless they were left out. Eventually, they were going to bring them in, and it was conditions-based. Michael Allen joins us now, former special assistant to President Trump. Michael, welcome back. Your thoughts about what Admiral Kirby said.
Well, I think he's got it all wrong. I mean, the major difference, let's just cut to the chase, is that it was Biden who executed the plan. President Trump did not. President Trump had the foresight to realize that the conditions that needed to be met were not obtained, and he didn't try and rush the troops out of Afghanistan at the end of the day. Biden did against the, you know, he was kind of like a know-it-all about the whole thing, against the advice of his generals. It didn't work, and as President Trump said in the debate the other night, it was one of the more embarrassing episodes in American history.
And the damage it caused, I think it's directly related to the invasion the Russians did in Ukraine, and obviously we lost billions of dollars worth of equipment, and we now lost the ability to find out what ISIS, ISIS-K, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban are up to. China? We lost the looking glass into China, Russia, Pakistan?
You're exactly right. I mean, we just had the anniversary of 9/11. Of course, we know that terrorist groups congregate and plan to hit the United States in ungoverned spaces. That's what Afghanistan was. That's what it is again. Not even the Taliban can reach out into the really rural areas and take on terrorist groups, even if they were inclined to do so, which they're not. Al-Qaeda is growing back. And when you talk about the capabilities of the U.S. intelligence community to keep us safe, we're only as good as the intelligence that we get about where they're hiding and what their plans and intentions are. We can maybe, like Biden says, send some drones in all the way from the Persian Gulf or elsewhere in the Middle East to get to Afghanistan, but it's no good if we don't know where to hit, so we don't have a presence there. That was a bad call. We should have kept some troops on Bagram Air Force Base because, you know what, Al-Qaeda, ISIS-K, the rest of these terrorist groups still want to hit us. They haven't gone away.
So yesterday, Russia and China held the biggest war game since the Soviet era. We're talking about 90,000 troops, 400 ships, submarines and vessels, 120 planes and helicopters. What messages are they trying to send to us, and what observations do you have?
So we know that they have the friendship without limits, and this is just another example of how close they're getting. It's not just rhetoric. It's that China is basically bailing Russia out in terms of goods and military equipment and dual-use equipment that Russia needs to continue to rape and pillage in Ukraine. It's these ex-military exercises that shows they're becoming more and more integrated. So it's another reason why when our voters out there and everyone want to look at who the commander-in-chief should be, it's a reminder that we've got a very complicated picture. By the way, a very important commission on the national defense strategy of the United States said in late July that this is the most complicated and serious threat environment since the end of World War II.
No question.
I mean, that's amazing. And we don't have the military equipped to handle these kind of threats. We don't have enough intelligence to handle these kind of threats. And we have to step up as a country and ask for more for our defense spending, and we need to be more forward deployed.
I agree.
To get into wars, but to prevent them.
Right. Strength. People don't want to mess with people that are strong and growing as opposed to, reducing. How do you feel about beginning to I want to up the military-industrial complex. I think it's too small. It's got to be diverse. We gambled. We told them to consolidate. They did. And now we're kind of stuck. They need to go compete again. And I'd like to have our allies pay for their own defense, but buy our stuff. We'll train them. We'll be there. But they could buy our stuff and be ready for the and have the best stuff in the world to defend themselves and not make them such a target-rich environment.
You're exactly right. By the way, they're dying to buy our stuff. We can't build it fast enough. And I'll tell you, one of the most frustrating things, and this honestly goes back to the end of the Cold War, we all celebrated, declared that we should cut defense and intelligence. We called it the peace dividend. And honestly, we're paying the price for that decades later. It's because our defense industrial base is atrophied to such a degree that even if the Congress wants to put $5 more billion around submarines or an additional carrier, we don't have the naval industrial base ready at this moment to go forward. We don't have the right workers. We don't have the right training. There are so many different things we need and have to do. In terms of munitions, you're right. Those European companies want to buy from us. They are doing more. They need to do more and more. But they're beginning to step up, like Trump asked, like President Bush asked, and like everyone has asked. But we got to be able to fund them.
Absolutely. Michael Allen, thanks so much. There's a lot going on today, and we'll get to it. Thanks for getting to it. Meanwhile, coming up next, Ricky Kopp. We'll go inside sports. Tua Tagovailoa last night got another concussion, his fourth in 2 years. Some are saying he should leave the game at the top of his game. How do you feel about that? Dolphin fan aside, what is the right thing to do? Brian Kilmeade Show.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Fourth and four. Pressure. Tua steps up. He's going to run for the first down and takes a shot at the six-yard line. Hamlin hit him and Tua down. Picked up the first. Split the seam, but pays the price.
So that is Tua Tagovailoa, and you know he's the Miami Dolphins' outstanding quarterback. Just signed a huge long-term deal despite having four concussions. And after last year, he played concussion-free, played well, obviously. The Dolphins made the playoffs. And then last night, took a shot from, of all people, DeMar Hamlin on Thursday Night Football and got knocked out of the game. Now, he plays in 10 days. Question is, should he and will he be playing again this year? Or how long should he be out, being that he's in now concussion protocol? Let's bring one of the newest members of the Fox family with OutKick.com, Ricky Cobb, host of the Ricky Cobb Show on OutKick, Mondays through Fridays, beginning at 11 a.m. Ricky, welcome. Congratulations on the job and coming over here.
Hey, good morning, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. I'm proud to be a part of the OutKick and Fox family.
Yeah, so what's your thoughts about what happened last night when you heard Al Michaels on the call?
I think it's deeply concerning. I had Brett Favre on my show last week, and he was talking about the concussions that he suffered during his career. Now, Brett never had anything like what we've seen now a couple of times from Tua, but Brett believes that he's had over 1,000 concussions in his life because an expert told him that every time you see stars, you have experienced brain trauma. So it doesn't have to be something nearly this dramatic. But when you see something this dramatic and it looks like a pattern, I think this kid really needs to start thinking about his future in a very thoughtful way.
Interesting. Here's what Rob Gronkowski just told us on Fox and Friends, Cup 40.
And I think he should be back within the next, I would say, 5 weeks, because he signed a $225 million deal. So it was good to see him walk off the field, let him heal, let him go through the protocol, and then it's their starting quarterback. They need him.
that's the Rob Gronkowski. Rob said, I think I've had just as many.
He probably has. He probably has. I just think at a certain point, obviously Tua is a young guy. He's at the peak of his game. He's become one of the upper tier quarterbacks in the NFL. Nobody wants to walk away from that, but you got to think about your future. You got to think about your family. You got to think about what you want your life to look like when you're 50 years old. And I know that that's difficult to do when you're a young man and when you are in such a celebrated position as being an NFL quarterback, but I think it's becoming very, very concerning for him.
Wow, very interesting. So it's going to be the hot topic over the weekend. You have some people like Dez Bryant, former wide receiver with the Cowboys, saying, no way, call it a career. Tony Gonzalez, the same thing. So we'll see what happens. I mean, he's going to get paid regardless, so he's not going to be homeless. But it will destroy the Dolphins if he drops out. The other thing, that just talking football, Tom Brady's first week in the booth, what do you think?
I think that the potential is clearly there. If people thought that he was going to come out of the gate week one and he was going to be the GOAT of color men in NFL history, I don't think that's a realistic expectation by any means. Obviously, Tom Brady is a good talker. There's few, if any, who are better equipped to be able to break down NFL action for fans. I think if he commits himself to it, if this is something that he decides that he wants to do on a long-term basis, Tom Brady's going to be one of the better announcers that we've seen, but it's a growth process for him, and I think it will take him a little while to grow into the role.
Yeah, I tell you what, I thought it was real good. And the thing is, they said, you know, is he going to be critical? That's going to be the tough part. When he sees mistakes, maybe lazy mistakes that people are making, guys that he knows, is he going to say, well, that was a terrible pass? I don't know what he was thinking there. You know, he was staring that receiver right down, and if I'm the coach, I think it's time to make a move with this quarterback. That's tough because he knows how tough the position is. So, I don't expect him to. I thought he was fine. You know, and I think the people that think he's going to be great right away have little respect for how hard that job is. It is really hard to speak concisely, quickly, with the pace of the game in real time. So I have a lot of respect for play-by-play and color. It's so much different than just knowing the game.
There is a learning curve, and you're absolutely right. To think that he's going to walk into that world and he's immediately going to be as elite as a broadcaster as we know that he was as a quarterback. It's just not realistic. But I agree with you. It was a perfectly solid debut. I think he has a high floor and a high ceiling as an announcer. And one thing we know about Tom Brady, Brian, is when he commits himself to something, he commits himself to something. So if this is what he decides he really wants to do over the course of the next decade or couple of decades, I think he's going to end up being a very elite announcer.
You know, I think it's going to be interesting if they're going to break and allow him to go to these meetings. Evidently, since he wants to be he's aspiring to be part owner of the Raiders, all these teams are saying, I don't want him sitting in our production meeting. So when you get all that great information from the quarterbacks and the coaches and they feel open talking to you, as you tell them, I'm going to be with the Raiders soon, I don't blame them for not, even though it's Tom Brady, I don't blame them for not letting him in the production meetings, but that will hurt him.
That's the thing that concerns me the most, actually, of everything that I've heard, is you can't do everything. Tom Brady obviously has a huge appetite for doing a lot of things, and sometimes you have to decide what the priority is, and I think if he's going to maximize his ability as an announcer, he needs to be able to get to a point where he's comfortable being critical, as you alluded to, and he needs to be in a position where he can go to these meetings and he can do the prep work that all of his peers are doing. He's handicapping himself if he tries to have one foot in ownership and one foot in announcing, and I think that's potentially the biggest pitfall that he faces.
I want you to hear, this is Tyreek Hill pulled over. Everybody knows by now, I think, the outstanding wide receiver with the Dolphins, pulled over in his McLaren automobile that opens up like a DeLorean. That's what the door does. The door goes way up. But he's en route to the game. He gets pulled over. At first, he said, the cops were bad and all this stuff. But then he admitted he could have handled it better. Listen to this exchange.
Keep your window down. Keep your window down. I'm going to get you out of the car. As a matter of fact, get out of the car. Get out of the car.
Give me up. I'm going to break that window.
Get out of the car. Get out of the car right now. We're not playing this game. Get out.
Get out. Get out. Get out. Get out. What part of the problem is doing? Hey, Drew, I'm getting arrested, dude.
So Dolphins end up pulling over. They end up putting another guy in cuffs and threatening to put another guy in cuffs, half his team. And right now he's on leave. So Tyreek Hill is demanding this cop be fired. Where does this go, Ricky Cobb?
I'll say the same thing that I said while we were waiting for the body cam footage. Everybody was jumping to conclusions. I said, let's wait. Let's get the facts. We saw the body cam footage. I think there's some blame to go around here. Certainly Tyreek Hill, if he had done what any of us have been taught to do and what we know to do when a cop pulls us over, which is roll down the window, put your hands on the steering wheel, cooperate, there's a 99.9% chance that is just a routine traffic stop. And Tyreek was not honest about his actions and his initial comments that he made before we had access to this footage. I do think that the cops escalated the situation beyond perhaps where it needed to go. I put a little blame on both sides, but Tyreek Hill, had he done what I think would have been the wise thing to do, that's he gets a ticket and none of us hear anything about this and life goes on.
I don't want to see the cop fired.
I want to see the guy fired,
but he did
his job too much.
But I did know this, the cop that was leading this was a lot more hyper than the other cops. The other cops were very calm. So law enforcement officials, I think you work with the guy, you do not fire the guy. You can't just go call for the firing of people. And I think it would have been, I like the way he handled it up until that. And then he admitted he was wrong. He said, I could have handled it better. But the other thing is, and it's not an excuse, it's just an observation. When you get a football player before the game, a lot of times they're like, you never talk to a boxer before a fight. For the most part, they're in that war mindset. So that's in his mindset, he's in, I'm going to war. So it's not an excuse, but it also is a mindset that people are familiar with who play football. Ricky, what's your show like? What's your approach with your show?
The approach with the show is to try to cover the things that people care about. We talk about what's going on. We've talked about certainly Tyreek this week covering that, but we want to have fun. a lot of great interview guests. I try to walk the line between smart and serious and silly and irreverent. And I hope that the show checks a lot of those boxes, Brian.
I also know you did an interview already with one of my favorite people, David Wells. You were talking pitching, yes. Big picture. That guy was a horse, an innings horse, even years when he was 10-10. He just never came out of the game. This is him talking to you about what's changed.
We played a lot of long toss. We played catch every day. To me, I take that all those years of playing long toss, you know, what got me through those long seasons. Some of my ex-teammates now who are involved in the game, they don't do that anymore. They don't play long toss. They don't do anything. They work on the analytics of the game, zones that they got to pitch in. Well, we had to pitch in zones all the time. We had to figure guys out. And now they got everything on a silver platter for them these days. To me, it's just a matter of mindset, going out there and execute.
There's really no pressure, really, to go past six innings, right?
In this day and age, there really isn't. And I was reading where, and I don't know the veracity of this, but that there's been some discussion behind closed doors of Major League Baseball thinking about trying to make it a minimum of six innings unless you give up a certain number of runs. I think they said four earned runs was what was being floated. Or of course, if you're injured, the starting pitching position has been so devalued, Brian, over the course of the last decade. And there's been a move towards that, obviously, for a long time in baseball. Complete games have almost evaporated. Blake Snell, who threw a no hitter not long ago, had two Cy Young awards, Brian, before he had his first major league complete game.
Amazing.
That would have been absolutely unthinkable when we were growing up.
Right. I mean, sometimes, yeah, I mean, people used to grind it out, and then there'd be this thing called stoppers and Bruce Sutter, and you'd have once one of these, that became a new thing when I started following baseball. Who's the stopper? Who's your stopper? You got Rich Gossett. That's your stopper. Now it's who's your middle reliever? And now, like, the middle relievers are the most valued for baseball insiders, but undervalued by fans. But they're the ones, there's the bridge to your fireballer. And if you don't have a good bullpen, you're not going to win a series because you just can't expect more than six innings from great starters. Ricky Cobb, that was a great interview, great perspective, and best of luck on OutKick.
Hey, Brian, thank you so much, my friend. I really appreciate it.
All right, and look for a Ricky show at 11 a.m. Monday through Friday. Back in a moment, 1-866-408-7669, Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The first words out of that fighter's mouth is, I want a rematch. I want a rematch. And that's what she said. I want a rematch. Polls clearly show that I won the debate against Comrade Kamala Harris. But she immediately called for a second debate, which means that she was like a prize fighter that lost a fight. We had two debates, though. I had a debate with Crooked Joe Biden, right? And I had another debate with her. She was a no-show at the Fox debate. You know, Fox invited her. She was a no-show.
So that was President Trump yesterday, and I hope he stays busy. One thing he does is, man, he's got this great energy, 78 years old. When he was 72, same thing. There's no difference. And I love to see him out there as much as possible. Kamala Harris is going to do that. She's going to compete hard. Joe Biden would never have been able to do that. So I think he's going to it's interesting because she's going to rural areas that are going to go for Trump. She just wants a few percentage points. And what Trump is doing is going into cities, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. And he's going into, you know, went into Chicago famously, and he'll go into New York. And I'm not sure New York's not going to go to him, but in these battleground states, go to the areas in which normally you don't think you're going to win the majority of. For example, in Georgia, if I'm Trump, I would do something that Herschel Walker didn't do, and that is go right into Atlanta, much as possible. Go into Atlanta and find out what's going on. You walk the streets, you walk the areas. So let's say it's 80-20, 80% is going to go for Harris. You walk in there, you get 2 or 3%. You get 2 or 3%. You get 2 or 3% from the areas that go to Harris or Democrats. and then you go back and maximize what you could do in your areas, or trust that your ads are going to tell the story, or your voters are going to be so loyal they don't need to see you. And I think that's a sound strategy. But look, they got a lot of people that know what they're doing. They got a ton of money. And I think that if Trump loses, it won't be because of money. But a couple other things. I just think, check out this story in the LA Times. The moderator, female moderator there, basically said it was their goal to fact check. They made it their goal to thoroughly go over all the speeches and rallies of Donald Trump, go over the last debate and his previous debates, and point out and make sure he's held accountable. Fact check him in real time. They don't feel they had to fact check Kamala Harris. I don't want to spend this whole time on the debate, but the thing that stuck out to me, I'm getting these little flashes. Remember what she just says? Thanks to nobody has died overseas since no one's in a hot war right now. Right now, no, there's nobody. None of our soldiers, our armed forces, are in harm's way. Really? You don't think they're in harm's way right off the coast of the Middle East? You don't think they're in harm's way when the Houthi rebels are shooting rockets at them? You don't think they're in harm's way when rockets go flying in from Iranian-affiliated militias and kill three of our guys in Syria? You don't think those 2,500 in Iraq are in harm's way? You don't think these are war zones? She got away with that. If you're really fact-checking, and it's a tough thing, man, you're going to fact-check. You're going to go down there and be moderators that fact-check in real time. You got to be a genius, win Jeopardy 25 times. Number one. Number two, you got to do both sides. So if they at least tried to do both sides and said, you know, Ms. Vice President, that's not the way it happened. You know, the Doha Agreement was the Doha Agreement, but you didn't have to implement anything. You have to implement almost nothing that Donald Trump did. You undid everything he did from the XL pipeline to building the wall. It's costing the country millions of dollars, billions of dollars just to let that wall rot in the desert. So the Doha Agreement was not mandatory. You do whatever you want. David, listen on WHIO. Hey, David, in Springfield, Ohio. David, how are things?
I'm tired of hearing people who don't live here and don't know what they're talking about run their mouths. I know that.
Tell me what the reality is.
Well, one, you said earlier that National Guard is out here.
I'm sorry, could you say that again? You broke up.
Yeah, you said the National Guard was out here running around.
Well, they said they're heading down there. He's sending them, right?
They ain't heading down there. I can't believe people are listening to DeWine, dude.
He's your governor. He's your governor.
Yeah, I know, and he's an idiot, and I voted for him. He's an idiot. This man sat here and says this and doesn't do anything. He ain't got no backbone.
David, hang on. I'm going to hold, if you can, well, call back, because I don't want to cut you off. We're up against a break now. We'll have you in the next hour, because I want to get your story.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. Brian Kilmeade Show. Great to have this hour. Congresswoman Ashley Hinson will be here, member of the Appropriations Committee, Republican Study Committee. The chance to keep in the House, also Homeland Security, how it relates to what's happening at the border, what's happening in all of our small and big cities. And, of course, we had that news last night. Boeing, one of the two big jet builders, they are on strike. So they did not want a 25% raise. They want a 40% raise. So they went on strike. There's really Airbus and Boeing. Besides that, no one's building planes at a big rate. So it's important for them to try to fix this. Boeing's been an absolute mess. With me in studio is Emily Schrader. She is a journalist and Israeli human rights activist. But before we get to Emily, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
We will hold social media platforms accountable. If you act as a megaphone for misinformation, we are going to hold you accountable.
Cracking down on social media titans. How about what's happening in Australia? They're cracking down. How about banning X from Brazil? I guess you could say they're cracking down. EU has already sanctioned major tech companies like Google as well as Apple. What about here? It seems like people have a huge problem with Twitter now that Elon Musk owns it. We'll talk about what the right thing to do is with the tech giants.
Number two.
What we are is a city that only wants our safety, security, and sovereignty back. We've had total upheaval because of it. Our food pantries, they get stripped. Our emergency rooms are overrun.
That is true, and that is part of the problem. When you break the border, it's not just a border town. everybody's a border town. They used to just punish the El Pasos of the world, the Tucsons of the world. Now they're punishing cities like Springfield, Ohio, like Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's happening. We know in New York City, 67,000 illegals are here, and we're paying for them. And in California, guess what? They now want to pay their phone bill.
Number one.
We will end all taxes on overtime.
The people who work overtime are among the hardest working citizens in our country. And for too long, no one in Washington has been looking out for them.
53 days and more and no more debates, but seven states, seven battleground states will be battled for. And as Donald Trump says, no taxes on tips. He says health care companies should do the IVF. Now that should be mandatory. And now he says no taxes on Social Security and no taxes on overtime. Does that win over your vote? We'll discuss the economic advantages the Republicans seem to have. Emily Schrader, one thing is for certain, the next president will have to deal with Israel. And I think in Israel, they're not going to say it, but they have to feel better about the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. How do you feel just back from Israel yourself? Yes, this morning, right?
Yesterday I arrived. Yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for having me on again. Always a pleasure to be here. I think that the consensus in Israel is obviously that we're going to have a friendlier situation with a Republican administration, of course. And Donald Trump has an excellent track record when it comes not just to Israel, but actually the entire Middle East, with the Abraham Accords, with everything else that he did, how he kept Iran in check, which I would argue is actually a much bigger deal for the next president than Israel, what they're going to do with the Islamic Republic. So, of course, in Israel, the majority of people across partisan lines acknowledge, even if they don't like Trump, that Trump would be the better pick for the Middle East and Israel.
Well, for one thing, Gaza. Just from you, what you've noticed, would you personally feel and what the people of Israel feel about the ceasefire deal? We see the thousands, tens of thousands in the streets demanding the hostages back and Netanyahu do more. Do you believe that he should be doing more?
I mean, I don't think it's completely up to Netanyahu. I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction with Netanyahu. I have my own criticisms of him.
How the war's being done or prior to allowing
both, Both. I think the lead up to this war has been disastrous. The Israeli government has definitely failed their people. However, what we need to focus on right now is Hamas, because Hamas is who is responsible for what we're seeing now. Israel has offered deal after deal. They have accepted terms that are frankly dangerous, that many people feel are dangerous, including the release of terrorists. Some of the terrorists who were released in previous deals have already recommitted security offenses. So we know that that's something that
one
we have to
deal
Sinwar.
With. One of which is Sinwar.
Of course.
The bin Laden of this operation.
In the Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange, Yahya Sinwar, who masterminded this October 7th massacre, was released. So this is something that we have to deal with. At the same time, the way that the Israeli public feels, we will do anything to get our hostages home. And I think Netanyahu is included in that. If there is a deal on the table that Israel can accept, Israel will accept. And we will deal with the security challenges after, because those lives are more important.
How many hostages do you think are left?
So we have 101 hostages still there. At least 30 of them we know are deceased. Beyond that, I really don't know. You know, it's anybody's guess. We do know that Sinwar is using hostages. Probably some of the more high-profile hostages are physically with Sinwar.
I heard that there was an operation that's been found out that he planned on escaping with some hostages to Iran through some of those tunnels. That was something written up in the Jerusalem Post, I think. How valid is that?
I mean, we don't know for sure. There's a lot of rumors going around in a lot of different sources, but it's entirely possible that is something that Sinwar would do. So I wouldn't be surprised at all. That's been part of the reason that the Philadelphia corridor on that Egypt-Gaza border is so important for Israel to maintain, because that is a way that they can get out, that Hamas terrorists can get out. So it's important that Israel control that, as they do right now, as we speak.
I see that we found out that the hostages, the six that died, were fighting to the end. Number two, we found out the horrific positions, the situation they're in. The young lady was down to 76 pounds, just power bars in a tunnel that they couldn't even stand up in.
Yeah, there was not room for even two people to stand up at a time, despite the fact there were six hostages being held there. They found some, you know, empty water bottles. They were supposed to bathe and drink from the water that they had to bathe in. They found on the bodies themselves multiple gunshot wounds. They found evidence, physical evidence of, you know, not being able to bathe, not being able to see sunlight. a lot of really, really horrendous things. And let's not forget that one of these hostages who was shot in cold blood was an American citizen, Hirsch Goldberg Polin. So, and there are still American citizens who are being held in Hamas captivity. And so this doesn't just affect Israel. It is also an American issue. It is 100% an American issue. And we see that even on the streets with these protests.
And now we have some people who are critical of the way the war is being prosecuted in Gaza, that you should have done more for humanitarian purposes. I want you to hear some of the dialogue because it's indicative of some of the conversations at kitchen tables across the country. These high profile names, Bill Maher, Henry Winkler, on his podcast. Listen.
And my question to people who have this argument is always, do you know what's going on really underneath Gaza and all the tunnels and how close they are?
I do not know.
I don't either. But you know who does know? The Israeli Defense Force. Now, are they perfect? Absolutely not. But again, they're not the ones purposely killing civilians. They try not to kill civilians. If you can't understand that difference morally, then you're very morally confused.
Are you watching the same footage I'm watching?
You think they are trying to kill civilians?
I think that it is indiscriminate.
That's what war is.
Okay.
War becomes that. There is no war you can name that didn't. Sherman burned Atlanta to the ground, right. And it wasn't just the military people right. He was killing. It's a shame, but again, there's a very simple solution to this. Stop attacking Israel.
Is he right?
I mean, I think
Bill Maher, is that a conversation you hear a lot?
I think it's partially correct. I completely disagree that war is indiscriminate. I think that the IDF has really gone above and beyond when it comes to Gaza. And if you want to know more about targeted attacks, look at what's happening in the north, which is actually becoming a much bigger front. Even this morning, I woke up here in New York. I woke up to dozens of rocket alerts of Hezbollah firing rockets at civilians in the north in Sfat, not just in the territories right on the border, but even further in. And this has been going on all week, significant escalation. And yet you see what Israel is doing, what the IDF is doing, both in Syrian targets and in Lebanese targets of Hezbollah, is targeting only military infrastructure. There have been very few casualties when it comes to dealing with that. Gaza is a little bit different situation as of now because Hamas has been using civilian infrastructure, including schools, mosques, all over the Gaza Strip, and using children around them in order to insulate themselves because they know that if the ratio is too high of civilian to combatant, that Israel will call off strikes. And there is also documentation of that, too. There's evidence of the pilots, of the drone operators calling off airstrikes because of the presence of civilians. And unfortunately, they know that. There was a video that was released just a few days ago from Gaza on Palestinian social media of a sticker company that was printing out large UN stickers to put on Palestinian vehicles in order to prevent the IDF from targeting them. So that just goes to show that even the Palestinians in Gaza know the truth, that Israel is doing everything they can in order to avoid civilian casualties.
Yeah, we had John Spencer on from the War College at West Point, and he came out and said that percentage-wise, it's lower than we did in Iraq. We don't know if we have it in Afghanistan, but definitely in Iraq with Ramadi and Fallujah. We know how dense those populations were and how we went out of our way. And Israel is not criticizing the U.S. and saying you should do a better job on civilians.
Absolutely true. I mean, I think the most important thing right now is that we see a unified Western support, not just U.S., but of course U.S., when it comes to dealing with terrorist organizations. Because as I said, this issue is much bigger than just Hamas.
So I hear you are making, not you, but the IDF is doing some damage to Hezbollah. So Nasrallah is scrambling a little bit. The damage has been done to him, and he's almost concerned about an escalation, whether he could do it. I'm concerned about the IDF having a two-front war, but what are your thoughts?
I mean, the reality is we already have more than a two-front war. We're dealing with the Houthis from Yemen. We're dealing with Hezbollah in the north, also the IRGC, the Islamic Republic's forces and terrorist proxies in Syria. We're dealing with infiltration of Iranian allied terrorists through the Jordan border in the West Bank. So we're dealing with multiple fronts as it is already. We can't say that it just started now either. Hezbollah has fired thousands of rockets and suicide drones from across that border, the northern border, since October 8th, literally thousands, almost every day we've seen this. And just in the last week, we've seen a significant escalation from Hezbollah. At the same time, we've also seen the IDF responding very strongly, taking out some very, very serious Hezbollah leaders even this week. Part of the reason we have seen some of that escalation. But at the same time, you see a stark contrast. The Hezbollah terrorists are targeting civilian towns like Sfat this morning. And Israel is targeting Hezbollah terrorists in order to prevent this from escalating. And one more thing I want to add that's really important is that we're seeing opposition in Lebanon. You know, the Islamic Republic of Iran has destroyed Lebanon. They're responsible for a lot of the chaos there through their proxy, Hezbollah. And we are starting to see for the first time Lebanese voices speaking up and saying, we don't want a war with Israel. We don't want this conflict. And we are the ones who pay the price. And they're exactly right. So I want to encourage any Lebanese to speak up against Hezbollah because we have the same interest on
them. You have some Christians there that used to be the dominant ruling force. And now you have Muslims who don't want to hear from the Christians and they have their role. And then you have used to have a huge Palestinian presence. They kicked them out. And next thing you know, they're in the West Bank and in Gaza. So they've also were in Jordan, got kicked out of Jordan, the Palestinians. Although we wonder sometimes because we just saw King Abdullah with Abu Mazen the other day. Big smiles on their faces. There's nobody to deal with on the Palestinian side. Is there any voice of reason on the Palestinian side, a leader that you hear on the news on a regular basis giving their perspective?
No. to answer you abruptly, no.
Go to Yasser Arafat, right? We used to know.
But even Yasser Arafat was, you know, supporting terrorism at the same time in Arabic that he was saying, oh, yes, we support the right of Israel to exist. So it's very, very difficult, the Palestinian situation. And I think that's why it's so important that we see leadership from the West and even from other moderate Arab countries pressuring the Palestinians, because that's the only way that we're going to see a better future for Palestinians. Of course, for Israel, but also for Palestinians. And they just don't have that right now.
All right. And I just want you to hear what John Kirby said yesterday.
Yes, Hamas did change some of the terms of the exchange, and that has made it more difficult for us to get there. I'm sorry, your second question was?
Would you still characterize the deal as on the verge?
We still believe that even for the new amendments that Hamas has made, that that it's still worth an effort to try to see if we can't get back into a ceasefire negotiation, but we're not there right now.
That is not optimistic.
Definitely not optimistic. And I think that pans out with everything we know to be true about Hamas throughout this operation. You know, I appreciate that the United States is trying and that they're hopeful about it. But the reality is that when we're looking at the hostage situation, what happened with the execution of those six hostages, including an American citizen, is that we needed and need the West to apply pressure where Israel can't diplomatically. Israel doesn't have the same diplomatic levers to avoid war that the United States and other Western allies have. Why wasn't this done October 8th? Why wasn't Qatar pressured? Why wasn't Iran pressured? Why wasn't Turkey, that's been supporting Hamas, pressured? Turkey is a NATO member. NATO. And the United States did nothing?
They threaten to send their troops into Gaza.
I know. It's insanity. It's absolute madness that the United States, that the Biden administration has been so weak on this issue surrounding Israel. Right. I'm talking about even diplomatic, not military, diplomatic pressure from outside.
When Biden lands, he only meets with Israel. He was supposed to meet with other allies in the area, and they said no. So that was right there. It told you a story that was underreported. Emily Schrader, fresh off reporting in Israel. Thanks so much for joining us here in studio.
Thank you.
All right. Back in a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show. Bottom of the hour, Congressman Ashley Hinson. Also, we'll talk about what we now know about that debate and those moderators. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Meanwhile, Kamala Harris showed up spewing empty rhetoric, the same old lies, meaningless platitudes, offering no plans, no policies, and no details whatsoever. Nothing. The two anchors, David Muir and Lindsay Davis, sat there and only corrected me on things where I was right, but didn't correct Kamala on Project 25 that I knew nothing about, on the bloodbath hoax that has been totally debunked, which had to do with the automobile industry that is going to be dying.
So the President of the United States on his first rally yesterday announced what I think is pretty significant. If you work overtime, working class people, you punch a clock on some level, they should not be taxed. That'd be interesting. Well, they're not taxing tips. That's interesting. If your Social Security, you can't have your Social Security go up with the cost of living and not bankrupt it, apparently. So they can eliminate paying taxes on it. That's interesting. So the president's, though, everything he's doing is for working class people. So it's really hard to continue to label him somebody trying to benefit his billionaire friends. I think, I mean, I would think that people understand that. One of my points I'm trying to get across that it took me a day or two to realize is that the reason why those the debate was so unsatisfying for someone looking for answers, because there was absolutely no answers. I mean, we have stats that are overwhelming to show how bad the economy is compared to where it was. You probably want our economy more than any other country. Sure. But I'm just comparing it. I mean, you compare it economically. We were a lot better when Trump was in office. Immigration, much better when Trump was in office. The country changed. Yeah. You bring up Sanctuary City. Good luck with that. Maybe a few left-wing think tanks might think that's a good idea, but nobody thinks it's a good idea now. Not building the wall, good luck with that. Not thinking our border's a problem, even in the north, good luck with that. Of course it is. But I didn't hear any answers. We didn't hear any solutions. I heard different bits and pieces of programs. Now, I know what Trump's going to do. You know, for him to be asked about Obamacare, I mean, what is David Muir even thinking? What about Obamacare? Do you have a plan to fix it? He goes, I got elements. You know why? The answer should be, and it's easy now, the answer should be, listen, out of all my things I have to worry about, that's what I worried about when I got the job in 2016. Because the way it was implemented, jammed down everyone's throat, not fully flushed out, empty pages in it. That was the focus of the party when I took over. I wasn't able to pass it, famously. But now I don't have the priority. That's not a priority. My priority is the border, world peace, getting this economy growing, bringing back manufacturing, which means big tariffs. That should have been the answer.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The most significant geopolitical change in the world in the last 3 or 4 years is the cooperation of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. The degree that they cooperate and collaborate together and coordinate, it creates a dangerous situation globally. Why is that? Because if China started a war in the Indo-Pacific region over the South China Sea or Taiwan, it's likely that Russia would do much the same because they know the United States could not handle two, and we would find ourselves in a global conflict. That is the danger that is out there.
General Jack Keane with me 2 hours ago on Fox and Friends talking about the war games that were going on. Biggest, most significant war games since the Soviet Union was doing their own war games in the Black Sea or wherever. This time it was China and Russia together. And we watched, and we should be ready. Congresswoman Ashley Hinson joins us now in studio, a Republican out of Iowa. She's also on the Homeland Security Select Committee, also on the strategic competition between the United States and China. And we'll discuss that. Congresswoman, welcome back here on Appropriations, too. First off, your reaction to these war games going on.
Yeah. Well, I think we absolutely need to be strategic. And I've always been a big fan of strength with deterrence. And so that's what we need to be focusing on with our military. And we've had a number of those war games as well with our committee. And looking at what's happening with China and Taiwan, for example. And I think we need to absolutely be making investments. We also need to be looking at procurement in defense and how many parts within our Department of Defense and within our weapon systems are relying on Chinese parts. I think that's something that we absolutely need to be.
That stunned me. I had General Spalding on last week, and he said the biggest concern is that a lot of the components we need for our rockets and missiles are made in China, and they're beginning to slow down their delivery.
Right. And all they have to do is do that to mess with us. Right. And then our readiness goes down. Our ability to assist our allies goes down. You know, it's not just a personnel issue. It's an equipment issue. And there is a significant liability.
How irresponsible is it for these military firms to go cut these deals with China? Now, sometimes they say, well, it's all I have. You know, you have to be totally transparent with people like you. Say, listen, I got to buy this from China. Just so you know, there could be a national security interest, especially if both countries continue their divergent paths.
Yeah.
But what were they just worried about the dollar? They're worried about making money?
Yeah, I think it comes down to cost in manufacturing. And we admittedly have not invested enough in the past few decades in our own defense manufacturing base. And so when you look at that supply chain and the vulnerabilities that exist, I would applaud any company that says we're going to work on sourcing or friend sourcing many of these components going forward. And I have visited with a number of defense manufacturers who are looking at doing that because they understand they have an incredible vulnerability long term to be able to deliver on their contracts.
So also, China right now, we watched a assistant to the governor who's been there for years, has a multimillion-dollar mansion in Manhasset, Long Island. Turns out she's a Chinese spy. She's being investigated as a Chinese spy.
Right.
Then we have a former high-ranking law enforcement official who got a job he was not qualified for, appointed by Mayor Adams. He's being investigated as a Chinese spy. We also know they're setting up many police stations in America to clamp down on their own Chinese citizens or ones that have defected. We're just allowing them to infiltrate every way possible. Thousands coming through our southern border. What do you guys talk about when you're trying to figure out what they're up to on your committee?
Yeah. Some of this is absolutely a homeland security issue. You talk about the thousands of Chinese immigrants, mostly male, military age, that have come in.
By the way, what do they say? Do you know what they say when they come over, why they're coming?
I think they're trying to, most of them are not actually seeking asylum, right? They're coming in and they're the gotaways, right? So we don't know why they're here, what they want to do. I would point to a report that our committee actually put out last year. There was a bio lab discovered in California in Reedley. And I think it should alarm everyone because they had in that lab mice that were genetically engineered to spread COVID and other viruses. They had very dangerous diseases and vials labeled with like anthrax and things like that could be problematic for Ebola, right? I mean, that could be problematic for public health here in the United States. And I mean, that was just one of these biolabs that happened to be discovered because a code worker in that tiny little town flagged it for the FBI and the CDC. And if that had not happened, who knows? But that was a Chinese illegal immigrant.
Yeah, that was. And we know what they were doing in Houston, what they're up to in many ways in South and Central America, because they're coming into a country that barely needs aid. And they'll say, we'll build you that airport. We'll build you that port. We want a presence and we want part ownership. Oh, you can't pay me back? That's the Belt and Road Program.
Right.
And they're doing it through our own hemisphere. It doesn't seem like this administration even acknowledges it.
Yeah, no, and they send our our commerce secretary or treasury secretary Yellen went over, and I just feel like they are more about appeasement than again showing that strength, and I think that's the wrong message to take. I mean, you talk about the checkbook diplomacy, right? And it's truly debt trap diplomacy for many of these countries because when they're desperate and they're reliant upon cash infusions, the Chinese are coming in and doing that. And so I think it's important. I've been a big advocate for America First, but not America alone. And we need to be thinking about American interests and how the Chinese can come in and do this. And they've done it under our noses for 20, 30 years.
Right. Well, how much you miss Mike Gallagher in there?
Oh, I love Mike Gallagher. I'm happy for him, for his decision personally. As a mom to two kids myself, I know how challenging it can be to serve in Congress and do that. But I'm happy for him.
He was chairman of his conference that you're on.
Yes. And John Molinar is the new chairman of our committee. And he actually just got back from a trip. He went over to the South Pacific to continue to have those conversations and meetings with our allies over there, with Japan. And I think that, you know, those folks are looking to us for leadership here because, I mean, proximity is a big important reason why they need us. But they also need us for our military dominance and that deterrence.
So I'm watching one of these committee meetings on the Senate side yesterday, and both Republicans and Democrats exasperated in Intel and others who are continuing to deal with China and their manufacturing, pledged to know nothing about slave labor, even though they pledged to make sure that they wouldn't support it. Say, well, I'm against slave labor. I just have no proof that they're doing it. And I watched these CEOs sit there just acting like the most naive people you ever met. I mean, don't they ever salute the flag? Do they really? I'm a free market guy, but if I made my money sacrificing American security to China, I wouldn't be sleeping at night.
Yeah, this is American
millions of dollars.
It's greed, really, is what at the bottom of the line of here of what we're talking about is that they are choosing to look the other way if they don't acknowledge that that is actively happening.
Is that CHIPS program productive?
I don't think so, not yet. I think, you know, those
it's a good idea.
It is a good idea, I think, long term. But, you know, the bill that passed through Congress, I think, had too many loopholes that still would have benefited communist China. I want to see companies make investments here in chip manufacturing. We have ceded that to Taiwan, and now look at the situation we're in. And we certainly saw that exacerbated during COVID. You know, China is trying to develop its own chip programs and advance that. They're making significant investments in AI. They're not caught up to us yet, thank goodness. But if we don't continue to make those investments in domestic chip manufacturing, friendshoring, so that we can actually rely on that supply chain, it's not just chips and technology, it's medications. You think about the vulnerabilities that exist in that supply chain. And we already know China is not a willing partner to let us in to look at their facilities. And I mean, they will go so as they will go so far, and I actually had the commissioner of the FDA in my office last summer, I think it was, and he was saying, you know, they will go so far as to prop up an entirely fake facility and build it up so that they can pass the inspection when our people come in.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I know a lot of the AI companies are dealing with China. So what are you dealing with China? I mean, you should not be using them as a partner. They're not partners. They're not even in the space program anymore. We weren't cooperating with them. So what can Congress do to get these companies to understand dealing with China should not be an option?
Right. Well, and that's part of our committee's job, is to open people's eyes to the real threat that exists.
And threaten their lawmakers? But is there something lawmakers can do to these companies?
So I think we have to be very careful about threading the needle, understanding global flows of capital, right? And that's something we've been very cognizant of. What I think our focus has been is on really protecting American IP and making sure that if people are investing in these things, they know that their money is going there. You know, a prime example, we've got Heisei, who's listed on the NASDAQ, right? And they are a global LIDAR manufacturer. Well, this technology is, you know, it's military technology. It's in the ag space, but they have the dominant portion of the market. So if they're listed on an American exchange, those are American dollars that are going to a Chinese manufacturing company that is then investing in the military machine of China. So people need to understand. And I wrote a letter to the exchange to say, hey, you shouldn't. This is a DOD blacklisted company, right? I mean, they are working directly with the military in China. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be on the American exchange. So we can't have that double standard anymore.
So I'm sure you've seen these stories about these small towns being overrun by the illegal immigrants, the Haitians over in Springfield. And we have situations now in Pennsylvania, a couple of small towns. You're in a city right now, which is just overwhelmed with illegal immigrants. I was in Macy's yesterday. And as I'm walking through, I see three teenagers with stocking caps. You know, the ski caps that you know is in Iowa, where you could just see the face. Why, in 80-degree weather, don't speak a word of English, are they walking around Macy's with ski caps on?
Yeah, up to no good. And that actually makes everything more expensive for everyone else, right? Because our retailers
are
certainly—
But are you seeing that in Iowa?
Well, and, you know, Iowa, it's a little bit more nuanced. Our biggest issue in Iowa, and I've met with all of our law enforcement on this, we have Interstate 80 and 35, like just like a cross right through Iowa. So for us, it's really the trafficking side and also the drug side. You know, we talk a lot about fentanyl and how many people that's killing every single day. We had a near miss in Iowa recently where, thank God, an off-duty DCI agent happened to come across a woman who needed help. Who had an overdose. But we have a lot of methamphetamine problems coming in from its cartels, but it's also from China, right? So it's again, a direct result of the border. And you talk about the impact of mass illegal immigration. Even in Iowa, in my district, I have a small community in Northeast Iowa. I met with their superintendent and daycare facilities. And, you know, they were describing or lamenting having 100 kids come into a school district that can't handle 100 new kids.
You don't speak English.
That don't speak English. And then all of those teachers are completely overwhelmed. And not to mention, what does that do to student learning? I mean, we're already struggling post-COVID to catch people up. And then now you've got 100 new kids who don't speak English.
Let's talk about Trump-Harris, the debate. What's your takeaway? How do you think it's going to affect the overall numbers?
Yeah, I think most people watched that debate and thought it was one on three, right? I mean, I think we all saw what the moderators did talk about double standards to President Trump. And I'm a former journalist. I spent 11 years anchoring news and reporting in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I look at how they handled that, and I thought it was atrocious. It was a complete double standard. They didn't go after Vice President Harris for her flip-flops on her opinions, for her extreme views. And she may try to distance herself from President Biden. But as far as I'm concerned, she is directly tied to him and his policies. And she's going to talk like a moderate. But she clearly voted like a liberal when she was in the Senate. She's been out parading, talking about Bidenomics, and they just didn't call her for that.
So it's not just your opinion. We watched it. We saw the fact checks. We saw zero on her. And then it turns out in an interview with the New York Times, she said that her and David Muir went out of their way to make sure that Trump was fact checked. They went back to the June debate. They went to all his rallies. They went to his previous debates and wanted to be ready should he spout out what they thought was incorrect or fallacies. One of which was this story, you know, the story about Springfield was 100% true. The story about dogs and cats and things like that couldn't be verified. That was the focus. He called the city manager to make sure ahead of time. Wait, you're calling the city manager in Springfield, Ohio. Are you calling some of the, are you following up on some of the court cases of Kamala Harris as a DA and an AG in California? Were you trying to find out what, how many times had she said that she was going to ban fracking, decriminalize border crossings? Wasn't even an attempt at that. Right. And we find out that she was at, she's involved in the same sorority as Kamala Harris, this unique sorority.
Lindsay Davis. Yep. I think that we have to do a good job over the next 6 weeks of not only talking about her record, but talking about how patently unfair that was. The deck was stacked against him. And, you know, talk about Trump derangement syndrome. They didn't apply that same standard to fact-checking her. The good news is that the video evidence is out there for her record. And so, again, we just have to continue to point to the flip-flops that she's made, whether it's on energy, whether it's on taxes.
But right? She refuses to do interviews still. She says she'll do local interviews in some of the battleground states, not putting down local television, but that might be done. Not saying they're going to get an easy time of that, but we just don't know why you've changed on all these things. Right. We know that Donald Reagan was a Democrat, flipped over, became a Republican. Leon Panetta was a Republican, became a Democrat. If you ask him 20 days, every time, he'll tell you exactly why they changed.
Right.
It's as if she changed parties. That's how dramatic it is.
Yeah, and I think it's up to us to continue to put that pressure on, whether it's local media or on her campaign. You know, I find Twitter or X to be kind of an echo chamber a lot of the time, but I think it's our job as members of Congress to go out and really tell that story over the next couple months so our voters understand they're being hoodwinked here, right? And I think you look at her role on the border. They're trying to revise history here about what her duty was to control migration at the southern border. And now we have 10 million people in our country. We have Democrats in Congress who carried Biden's water for years, and then all of a sudden they're on board. I'd like to go back.
They were working with telling us how great Joe Biden was.
Right.
And you watch Ian Sams 2 weeks ago. He was telling us that Biden's great.
Right. And then you talk about local media, and she'll only do the media interviews with local media. It turns out, right, Biden's team was feeding these questions to reporters.
Yes.
So they already have an
good
easier
memory.
Time.
I already forgot about that.
Yeah, they already have an easier time coming into these preloaded interviews. And then they can prepare and be, you know, more polished. So I think that's I think it's an unfair advantage that. Again, like I said, it was Trump versus three. And we all saw that happen.
Ashley Hinson, the congresswoman from Iowa, the second district. Best of luck. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Best of luck in your election.
Thank you.
All right. You got it. Brian Kilmeade Show back with your calls in just a moment.
Coming to you on a need to know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm also announcing that as part of our additional tax cuts, we will end all taxes on overtime. You know what that means? Think of that. The people who work overtime are among the hardest working citizens in our country. And for too long, no one in Washington has been looking out for them. Those are the people. They really work. They're police officers, nurses, factory workers, construction workers, truck drivers, and machine operators. It's time for the working man and woman to finally catch a break, and that's what we're doing, because this is a good one.
So is it good enough that Kamala Harris will take that one, too? Yeah. And I thought Kevin O'Leary was pretty clear when he said said this. Cut 14.
Now, let's just talk about one policy I'm gravely concerned about. Taxing uncapitalized gains, which destroys capital formation. The reason people come here and why they invest here is to deploy their capital. Now, I got to know what that's about. Is that even a realistic idea? I can't believe that, because that would basically decimate the American dream.
Yes, and Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Dollars and Cents, said the thing about our country, that why money comes from outside and people try to get inside, is because there's opportunity. And you tax something like unrealized capital gains, and you just up the capital gains costs, period. People start going, well, you know what? I want to keep more of my money. It's not going to be worth it to be here. And for some reason, that didn't come up in the debate. Not by a moderator, not by Trump. That's a problem. But Trump would never do it.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. This hour, we're going to be talking to two very important guests. Fantastic leader. In my lifetime, probably the best leader that I've ever seen in action, Mark Messier. Hall of Famer, obviously. Now he's been a fantastic broadcaster. But he's celebrating 30 years since he broke the hex on the New York Rangers in their first cup since 1941. And it's been 30 years since they won it. He reflects back on that. He's going to be with us in 34 minutes. With me right now in studio, we're privileged to have with us back Tristan Harris. And I'm meeting for the first time Asa Raskin, co-founders of the Center for Humane Technology, part of a special that Oprah put together to find out what's next in layman's terms for AI. Guys, welcome.
Thank you so very much for having us.
You, did you say good things to Asa about me or bad, Tristan?
all good things.
It's all good things?
No, we had a great conversation last year, Brian. I mean, I remember it was when AI, GPT-4 was, I think, just coming out, OpenAI's model. And we had just released this talk called The AI Dilemma that really walked through all of the risks. Most people know our work through the film The Social Dilemma on Netflix, you know, which is about...
That's when I first saw you.
Right, right. And... you know, the whole point of this special that we did with Oprah that came out last night on ABC, it's now on Hulu for people to watch, is actually Oprah saw this AI dilemma talk that Aza and I gave, and she was so moved. She said, people don't understand what's coming. I want to help the American public understand this. And so she put together this special, and she got Sam Altman, Bill Gates, FBI Director Christopher Wray, Marilyn Robinson, Marques Brownlee, and us to talk about, you know, the full range of issues that are facing us, you know, unemployment from AI sort of disrupting jobs, biological risks, you know, safety risks, you know, and really the issue that I think we're trying to highlight is people want to ask, is AI going to be good or is it going to be bad? Is it going to be the promise or is it going to be the peril? And the issue is actually how fast it's coming, that the downsides of AI are kind of overwhelming our society, you know, overwhelming us with deep fakes, nudification apps
already.
In schools. Yeah, already. Mm-hmm.
So first off, how do you guys know each other?
Oh, yeah. Mm.
We've known each other for almost 20 years now.
Yep.
And we both share a deep passion for understanding how human beings work and then how technology intersects with it. So my father created the Macintosh project at Apple.
Wow.
So that iPad sitting there, you know, the lineage of all of that, his father started.
And, you know, Tristan actually worked very early on at Apple. And one of the things we think about is, like, what was the Macintosh? The Macintosh was about how do you take a complex computer and make it fit how human beings work? And what we're trying to do now is sort of a similar thing. It's like take something very complex, AI, and help humans understand how it's going to affect the world.
And we're both...
Some deep thinking.
Yeah, well, it requires it, unfortunately. I mean, right. AI is so complex.
Brainstorming,
but,
right?
But we're trying to simplify it for people because we have to get our head around it. You know, Aza and I are both builders. We're both tech entrepreneurs. We've raised venture capital. We've built tech companies. But we're concerned because a lot of our friends, you know, built the earlier generation of technology, which is social media, you know, our classmates in college, my classmates at Stanford. And we want to make sure that we don't make the mistakes with AI that we made with social media, because Brian, you know, we were talking backstage for a moment that, you know, people always say, but if we don't build AI as fast as possible, what about China?
Yeah.
Right. That's the ultimate question.
I actually just
question.
Said that to you.
Right.
Well, and this is the then fundamental question, which is, did we beat China to social media, but did that make America stronger or did it make us weaker?
Well, financially, it made us stronger. We got two of the, you know, you have Apple. And you have Bill Gates's, you know, Microsoft, two of the most powerful companies in the world. So you could say made us stronger, but might have made us weaker and more vulnerable, correct?
Correct.
Certainly to attacks.
Right. Well, so the business models of social media, if not the raw technology, it's the business. It's not the internet. People often say, is it the internet that's the problem? And we say, no, it's not the internet that made us, that kind of made us more addicted, distracted, polarized, sexualized, harassed society. It was the business model of this engagement for profit. That what is the business? You know, how much have you paid, Brian, for your TikTok account or your Facebook account or your YouTube account or your, you know, Twitter account? Nothing. How are they worth like a $1 trillion market cap? Well, it's because they're selling your attention. and they have to compete for how do I addict you? How do I make you scroll? In fact, actually, Aza, you want to tell the story?
Sure. So I invented infinite scroll. So that thing on your phone where you keep scrolling,
yeah,
and it just stops. Keeps loading more and more and more.
That was your idea?
That was my idea. Now, I invented it in 2006. That was before social media. And I made it to help people be more efficient. And then I had to watch as that invention got sucked up by social media and used to, you know, addict people, polarize people, cause people to doom scroll. It now weighs something like 500,000 human lifetimes every single month. And what I learned from that.
Can you back up? Can you say that one more time?
Yeah.
You said what you found out, dead scroll? What were you saying?
Doom scrolling.
Doom scroll. So what are you saying?
Doom scrolling is, you know, that thing where people sit on TikTok or Twitter and you just like, you can't stop scrolling because there's just so much bad news.
You're like, I really should stop. But I got into this trance and I like woke up 10, you know, 5 hours later and like, why do I feel like crap? It's like I've been doom scrolling.
Okay. Yeah. And then you followed up with,
That it wastes a huge amount of human lifetimes per month. Half a million human lifetimes per month goes into just scrolling. And what I learned from that is good intentions just aren't enough, that we have to build technology in a different way, because the way we're building social media was sort of like a Jenga tower where we were like the social media companies were getting new benefits to society at the cost of undermining things like a shared sense of reality. And now we're at risk of AI doing the same thing, that the companies are in a race to build more and more AI benefits to get out into market as quickly as possible. And so they make benefits like the ability for anyone to make super cool AI art or generate videos or audio, but it comes at the expense of pulling out the block of people knowing what's true.
Yeah. It's a lot to think of because it's very simple. I'm looking to get a product separate from tech. I'm looking for get a product that you want, and then I want you to buy a better one, or I want you to buy a replace it, whether it's a cartridge for a Coric machine. I want you to love my coffee, and that's good. That's free market. Yeah. I'm looking. Yeah. I want you to love the coffee, and then I want you to buy the little cups.
Yeah,
right. Then maybe the cups.
The interests are more aligned there because you want to keep buying coffee, and they want to keep selling you coffee.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
But you're saying that you guys approach this, you smart guys approach this, and your predecessors, your dad. Process. I'm just going to try to get something that people are going to want to keep using over and over again to maximize the success and to maximize the success of this company, make as much money as possible, employ as many people as possible, and move forward. And you're saying, wait a second.
Yeah.
Maybe we need different principles when we're approaching this rather than looking at it as just another vacuum cleaner or coffee machine.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So you're demanding people get that free market gene out of their body for this engineering?
Well, it's about what are we selling, Brian, right? So like, do we want to sell our shared sense of reality? Do we want to sell kids' mental health? So right now, you know, our 401k account might have Snapchat in it, but the more Snapchat stock price is going up, the weaker the mental health of basically all of these young people, because Snapchat's main user base is like teens and preteens, and their business model is not to help kids develop in a healthy way and be like another parent or a mentor or someone who's friendly.
360. You're thinking this whole thing.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because Brian, we're competing with China in a way that's about the overall health and strength and coherence of our society.
Interesting.
And we talked last time.
And they've already reined it in.
Yes, exactly.
They've reined it in already.
Because we talked, I mean, 2 years ago, I went on 60 Minutes and did that piece on TikTok and how in China, domestically, they regulate TikTok. They get the digital spinach version of TikTok when you go there. You open it up and you get education videos, who won the Nobel Prize. Here's a patriotism video for Xi Jinping. Here's financial advice for how to make you more wealthy. Yeah. And if you open up TikTok in the United States, you don't get that same version. We get the digital fentanyl version. We get the, you know, this is basically, you know, the most amusing ourselves to death kind of race to the bottom, you know, stuff. And that's going to dumb down our society over time. And that's why we have to fix this.
Let me ask you, how can they figure that out? Did we figure it out and ignore it before you came out with Social Dilemma? And did they figure it out and take stock in it?
Well,
the addiction, how it damages you mentally and socially?
What's happening is those parts of our society, the health of those parts of society don't show up anywhere on the company's balance sheet. So they're doing what makes sense for them, which is they're in a race to get to as many users as possible for market dominance, and they will take whatever shortcuts are required to win that winner-take-all game.
But they seem to care more about the mental health of their people.
Oh, you mean China?
Sorry, you were talking about
the companies. Talking about the companies, in the U.S.
But,
yes.
But China seems to care more about the mental health of their people. Am I right?
I think that they care about the mental health and development of their young population. And so they realize that they need to regulate their social media products. And, you know, we're not doing that. So they regulate TikTok to say you have to show educational videos. And we don't have anything like that. And I'm not saying we should do it the China way. But if we just throw our hands up and say whatever makes the most money to put in front of your 13-year-old, let's point a supercomputer at their brain so that when they flick their finger up like this, we just activated a supercomputer to figure out the trashiest piece of material that'll keep them scrolling for the longest. You run society through that for 10 years, you end up with a workforce that's not going to be healthy. The employers are not being able to employ, you know, the next generation. This is already happening.
What percentage of the engineers doing what you're doing in Silicon Valley or wherever they're located have this much concern that you seem to have about our mental health and where this is heading? What percentage?
That's a good question.
I don't actually know the percentage, but what we do know.
Are you rare?
What?
Are you too rare?
I think we're rare in the ability to speak clearly and publicly about it. But when we are talking to people inside of the companies, they will say, we are concerned. We just can't steer our companies. Can you on the outside please articulate what we on the inside feel?
Because they're caught, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg could be a good guy. He could be the nicest guy in the world. But he's trapped in a business model in which he's already anchored on a stock price that's dependent on as many people scrolling Instagram for as many hours a day as humanly possible.
And
he can't do that. He's trapped. So
he's almost asking for regulation on some level.
Well, yes.
Because he certainly doesn't need money.
No. Well, exactly. He doesn't need more money. And at the end of the day, it's like, what are we here to do? What is our legacy, Brian? What is the world we're leaving behind? What is the health of the country that we are creating? If he's a true patriot and cares about the strength and health of the United States, then we should be saying we need the laws that actually govern technology in a way that all of this technology that's affecting and constituting our minds and our psychology needs to be for benefiting us, not for harming us.
I want to take a short time out, come back so we have some time on the other end just to talk about what you guys, what's next for AI, where we're at and where we're going. Mm-hmm. Right?
Great.
Back in a moment.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Do you remember the first time that someone showed you evidence of AI being used to commit a crime? And what was your reaction?
I've been hearing about AI, you know, for a long time, even before I became FBI director. But one of the first memories I have of dealing with it in this job was I was in a conference room and a bunch of our folks got together to show me how AI enhanced deep fakes can be created. And they had created a video of me saying things I had never said before, would never say. And I was staring at this video of myself and I found it incredibly convincing. And it really, believe me, it caught my attention. I kept thinking, wait, that's not me. I never said that. What is this?
Tristan Harris here, Asa Raskin still with us, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. They're part of Oprah Special that's now on Hulu, but they were kind enough to come into our studio, and we'll talk to them next week on One Nation about AI, where we're heading. I need 9 hours, and it wouldn't be enough. But Asa, your response to the FBI director's response, that's an average everyday American response to something and the power of it, you're feeling?
It's exactly right, and it sort of shows the fundamental uncomfortable truth of AI. That the promise of AI and the peril of AI cannot be separated. All of the CEOs will constantly say, oh, we want to get all of the benefits of AI, but without the risks of AI. And it turns out that's just technically impossible to do because it's the same technology that lets you, say, instantly edit a family photo on your phone is the technology that enables deepfake nudes of teen girls across America's schools. The same technology that lets us develop new antibiotics is the same technology that can create super pandemics. And so the uncomfortable truth is as the AI companies are in a race to deploy more and more powerful AI, it continually undermines the foundations of our society. And because there is no accountability, the companies are not liable for any of these sort of downstream harms. It means that they aren't incented to try to make us safer at the same time as they create new benefits.
What are you doing about it, Tristan?
So
what are you recommending?
Yeah, so on the Oprah special, which I highly recommend people watch, or our AI Dilemma talk, we're recommending, you know, we're not doing anything right now in terms of laws, so there's a lot that we can do. It can start really simple, like liability, accountability, right? If you break it, you bought it. Parenti loci, if your kid breaks something in a store, you're responsible for what the kid does. So AI is like this little kid that we birthed. And if the kid is starting to cause some havoc, we need some laws where the companies, OpenAI, Google, Microsoft, are accountable for any harms that are created. So basic liability framework, we have one in our nonprofit Center for Humane Technology. It's on our website. People want to check out. Also whistleblower protection. So right now, as you know, people often say, but the government can't regulate AI. They don't have any AI expertise. That's exactly right. In lieu of that, we should have whistleblower protections, because the people who might be closest to where there's some risk or harm, is we got to protect the people inside the companies that are saying, hey, wait, there's some blinking red lights that are flashing.
We see when the FBI even said they actually have not been protecting their whistleblowers, and we've had them in front of Congress talking about how their lives have been ruined.
Yeah.
Real quick on TikToks, just a step back.
Yeah.
You were the first one to say we ban it. There's not even a question of it. Give me an example. Aza, you want to start, or Tristan?
Yeah. Well, so in November 2022, again, we went on 60 Minutes and talked about how this is ridiculous. Like, would you allow, imagine you're in 1968, right before the election, and the Soviet Union ran television programming for the entire Western world during the Cold War leading into an election. That's what TikTok is. They say they're not.
They say TikTok USA is different.
But now there's actually hard evidence.
How?
Rutgers University.
So Rutgers University did this study where they looked at, well, let's just see what kinds of hashtags trend on Instagram, US, versus TikTok, China. And for almost everything, you know, the hashtags sort of are roughly the same for both, except for the trends that are useful for the CCP. And there, those trends get much more virality. Many more people see things that are pro-CCP.
The topics for Uyghurs, for example.
Uyghurs or, you know, Israel-Gaza stuff. Everything that...
Anti-Israel.
Anti-Israel. All of the things around Ukraine. So all the narratives that China wants to see amplified in the world, they have the power to twist the knob and make it so that people see the perspectives that they want people to see. So now when you look around the world and you look in the US and you look at what's happening in Western countries and you say, you know, most people are getting their information from TikTok. It's the most powerful and most dominant, you know, social media app. We shouldn't be allowing this. This is ridiculous. And we were talking about this. Okay, why haven't we banned it yet? Well, as you said, going into this election, if you want to reach young people, all the politicians are trapped where they have to stay on the platform to try to reach young people, even though they no, they want to ban it. I mean, President Biden, you know, did the executive order to ban TikTok, but he also joined TikTok, like, I think, a few weeks later.
Same with Trump. He wanted to do it, too.
Exactly.
Guys, we just scratched the surface, but we'll come back. We'll talk about it on Saturday.
Great.
The Oprah special is on Hulu.
Yeah.
And, man, your concern has me concerned, but I appreciate you taking action.
We got to do a lot more. Thank you so much, Brian.
Clarity creates agency. Thank you.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
A kickoff for the Devils, plays it cross ice into the far corner. Matto swoops in to intercept. Matto behind the net. Swings it in front. He scores! Matto! The fan Matto! And the Rangers have one more hill to climb, baby! But it's Moot Vancouver! The Rangers are headed to the final!
So the guy that couldn't hear that call was playing in the game. He was captain of the team. That was Harry Rose, one of the best play-by-play guys. We're basically the same age, but he's been making Met games great. And any game he does in hockey, fantastic. But the guy I actually watched, I remember when the Islanders were winning Stanley Cups on Long Island, I was even seeing the WHA. There was this team in Edmonton. I would be following both leagues. And this team in Edmonton came in the league, and they were unbelievably talented with this guy named Gretzky. And this other guy named Mark Messier, and after getting stopped a couple of times, they went on their own dynasty run. But when Mark Messier came to the Rangers, that would be delivering the Stanley Cup. and it'll be the first time in 30 years. That was 30 years ago, and it was the first time since the 1940s. Joining us now, Hockey Hall of Famer, turned into a fantastic broadcaster, six-time Stanley Cup champion, Mark Messier. Mark, welcome back.
Well, thanks. Great to be on with you, and that call never gets old 30 years later.
Mark, when did you hear it? Because you were playing. Do you remember the first time you heard it?
Probably heard it the next day, watching all the replays or the clips. And since then, probably heard it 10,000 times. It never gets old.
How close were you? Remind everybody around, because we're not a 24-hour sports station. We're news. But my listeners are passionate about sports, too. But describe the scene and why it was so dramatic.
Well, I think, you know, original six team, the New York Rangers, hadn't won a Stanley Cup in 54 years. We had a great season in 1994, and the expectations were that we were going to hopefully try to win a Stanley Cup, but every other team for 54 years had failed in defeat. And so there was some anxiousness and some anxiety, a lot of pressure, and, you know, it came down to a Game 7. Against Vancouver, and ultimately we prevailed to win the first Stanley Cup in 54 years for the New York Rangers. So I think there was, you know, passionate fan base, generations of fans that have followed the Rangers, had never seen a Stanley Cup. You know, I think it transcended the game of hockey in so many different ways. It became bigger than just a sport at that time. So many people that never watched hockey became fans or tuned in across the country. And as you know, Ranger fans travel well, so it was an amazing time for all of us, something that we'll never forget. And here we are 30 years later, still talking about it.
And you're going to be talking about it at the Woodbridge Brewery, 33 Main Street over in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Mark Messier will be there. Other stars like Brian Leach, Mike Richter, Adam Graves, Stefan Matteau, and Coach Mike Keenan, who's never smiled, as far as I could tell, until that moment. He's a very stern-looking guy, intimidating, but he always gets results. So, Mark, you guaranteed that win in Game 6, didn't you?
Well,
against the Devils?
Yeah, against the Devils in the semifinal series, one of the best series I've ever played in. Incredible hockey. Devils had a great team, as we saw. They went on to win three Stanley Cups of their own. So, great young team. We were being pushed hard by the Devils that series. Found ourselves down 3-2. And needed to go into New Jersey and win Game 6, and had to figure out a way to do that after we'd lost momentum. And thankfully for Mike Richter, kept us in the game for the first half a game, where the Devils completely outplayed us. And then we finally got our footing, scoring late in the second period, and then scored goals in third period to win it. So it was one of those special moments in sports that you can't explain, but somehow or another we're able to win it and then go on and beat them in Game 7 back at MSG.
So when you came up, everyone knew you, but Wayne Gretzky, the greatest maybe to ever play the game, was also your teammate. It never seemed to bother you, but I always wondered, knowing that you were one of the top five players in the league every time you played, what was it like to always have Gretzky's name first?
Well, that's where he should be, first in every conversation when it comes to hockey.
True, but did it ever bother you, Mark? He seems like a great guy.
Never bothered me. He was the greatest, is the greatest hockey player that's ever played and will ever play. Nobody will come close to the records, 61 different records. He smashed his competition in his era. You know, talk about the greatest athlete in the last 100 years, probably. I think it went to Michael Jordan, but I think the statistics would tell you it's Wayne Gretzky. You know, never any kind of animosity, jealousy. We were a team. We were brothers. We were amazing a team in Edmonton. And the years that I got to spend with and play with Wayne were not only unbelievably successful, but also I learned so much from Wayne. You know, you look at a guy that's eight days younger than you, very rarely can you look at him as a role model. But Wayne was a special player, a special person, and was amazing to be able to play with him those years.
But you won without him here in New York. Did that make a difference?
It didn't make a difference to my relationship with Wayne or the way I felt about my own game. you know, hockey, like every other team sport, no one can win alone. You need people around you. You need the great people around you, character people, people that are focused and determined in order to win a championship. And I had that when I came to New York. I was lucky to have Brian Leetch and Mike Richter and Adam Graves and all the great players that we played with here in New York for that championship team. So, you know, I was lucky to leave Edmonton, which we, you know, won five Stanley Cups there, but to come to another franchise that had great young talent that were just as dedicated and focused as you need to be in order to win.
So from 86 until 97, I did sports, 24-hour sports radio, covering, especially in New York, started on Sports Phone, the lowest ring of the ladder. And so we would be covering everything in New York. And I always wondered from the Canadian perspective, there's something about a Ranger game. Here you are in the heart of the city in New York. Everyone thinks Canada and hockey. But when you go to a Ranger game, it was like going to church. The people that went there were on another level. And I wonder, for a guy that grew up in the sport, to come to New York not known for the sport, can you characterize the fans beyond passionate? What is it about them? How do you explain the bond with the Rangers?
Well, I think at time, I think, like I said, an original six team that has been around a long time. You think about the relationships that were forged through the New York Rangers with brothers and sisters and dads and moms and uncles and aunts and grandfathers, the special times that they spent together at Ranger games. You know, there was, when I came to New York, I felt it immediately that there was a passionate fan base, and one of the reasons why I felt so happy that I chose the Rangers to come to, because I think that makes a big difference in playing in the city where it matters to the people. So I was thrilled to have that kind of pressure and thrilled to have that kind of passion behind the team.
Mark Messier, our guest. So it's been 30 years since you won that. Mark, you're broadcasting. You seem to still, you're all over this game. You still seem to have the passion for it. But I always think you're synonymous with leadership. When you talk, I'm sure companies have you speak. I'm sure you're talking to youth teams, not just hockey teams. What is the dominant message, some of the principles that transfer for when you're not sweating, when you're wearing a suit, that could help you with people right now listening about leadership that you discovered?
That's a good question. You know, I think we, when you decide to play for a team or join a team in a company or whatever, I mean, there's some sacrifice that's required. There's some focus that's required. You have to learn how to be a good team player. You have to be selfless. You have to check your ego at the door, as everybody says all the time, but it's true. I mean, the team comes first in every way. And those commitments that are in order to, you know, play on a team that's trying to win a Stanley Cup is incredibly demanding. But, you know, the old saying goes, you win today and you walk together forever. And here we are 30 years later, about to meet this weekend at Woodbridge Brewery and reminisce about it, get together, have a good time. And we're looking forward to this weekend.
I watched 100 Years of Giants. They tried it out there, and the bond that they have, they named the top 100 Giants. And you think about Lawrence Taylor, you think about Phil Simms, you think about Eli Manning. Do you feel, even though you played on, you played in Edmonton, you played in Vancouver, you played for New York, do you look back in history? Do you feel that legacy of great Rangers?
Of course, I know the history of the New York Rangers very well. I know the great players that paved the way for all of us to here in New York to play and have something to shoot for. You know, the great names that are hanging from the rafters. The idea for me as a player was to try to win a Stanley Cup. Fortunately, we were able to win more than one, but it was always a focus to win, not to figure out how to get into the Hall of Fame or have your sweater retired. It was more about winning, and everything else seems to look after itself.
How do you like broadcasting?
ESPN's been great. Amazing experience for me. The people, Mike McQuaid, Mark Schumann, everybody over there has been so patient with me. It's a big learning curve. It's harder than it appears, but it's the best thing that I decided to do post-retirement. It's been amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do an unbelievable job. I'm just wondering, when that light goes on, is it even close to when the puck is dropped?
Well, you know, it's like anything else. You get the preparation. There's some readiness that goes along with it, especially in the playoffs and the Stanley Cup Finals. You have to be prepared. You have to be coherent. You have to be
coherent. That does help.
Because it matters. Breaking the game down and bringing the game into the living rooms of the people watching is important, especially if we can shine some light on some things that probably aren't that obvious to most people. So I think it's a big responsibility.
So you liked what we bumped in with. I think you'll like what we're going to bump out with. Stick around, but I want to get your response to this.
The chant of "We Want the Cup" going up from the crowd here at Madison Square Garden. I have been coming to this building since 1968 when it opened. I have never heard anything like this. Messier cuts in, still with a puck. Nice pass to Zubov. Zubov feeds Leach. Leach scores! Bubble off to the puck. Now Graves. He scores! Adam Graves! Soon as backhand is saved, and it's score! Messier! The waiting is over! The New York Rangers are the Stanley Cup champions! And this one will last a lifetime!
Sam Rosen, 3-2, the final. You score the winning goal in Game 7. How great is that?
Yeah, what a call. Sam, what a great friend. As we know, it's his last year. Going to be doing it. It's going to be a disappointing, sad time for all of us, but we'll relish his last year, and listening to it again there, it just gives you goosebumps. What a great guy. Him and JD are an amazing team.
They were. He was an amazing goalie, too. So this is it. Visit HallOfFameSignings.com or CXSStuff.com for details to get tickets. It's join Mark Messier, the 94 Stars, Brian Leach, Mike Richter, Adam Graves, Stefan Moteau, and Mike Keenan at the Woodbridge Brewery, 33 Main Street over in Woodbridge, New York. It'll be Saturday. That's Saturday tomorrow. Saturday, September 21st. So visit them there. Go get tickets now. They will go quick. Do not put it off. Mark, always great talking to you. Thanks so much. It's great to hear the passion and that you have another great career that you're in the middle of.
Yeah, I appreciate it and looking forward to seeing everybody at Woodbridge Brewery. It's going to be a great, great weekend.
All right, Mark Messier, who always stayed within himself. Back in a moment.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
All right, let me get started with more to know in the last few minutes. Chad McQueen, who famously played Dutch in the Karate Kid movie franchise, dead at just 63. Chad died at his ranch in Palm Desert, result of organ failure. Steve McQueen's only son. Chad is best remembered as the guy in the Karate Kid. Believe it or not, that was 1984, and then came back again for the sequel in 86. Next, a Chicago restaurant is serving the most expensive martini in the U.S., $13,000. I'm really not sure. Number one, I don't like martinis, so I probably won't be spending that. It's the Adelina restaurant serving Italian cuisine in Chicago. Regardless of whether you drink it, not stirred, the martini includes an exclusive piece of diamond jewelry. The restaurant, led by top chef Suhan, who Eric knows well and Pete is not familiar with, is collaborating with Marrow Fine, a jewelry brand located just below the restaurant. Along with the Marrow Martini comes a 9-carat diamond tennis necklace featuring 150 diamonds. I don't get it. Is it in? Is actually in the drink?
I guess so, but what else is in the cocktail?
What makes the Marrow Martini truly unique is the seamless fusion of fine jewelry and luxury dining. It's not just about the cocktail, it's about creating the elevated experience. Does that answer your question?
I'm sold.
All right. Hopper is an inspiration beyond the drink was taken from the high-end jewelry. So if you have enough money that $13,000 for a drink doesn't matter, I congratulate you. Next, more drinks, more schools rethink homework. Will California expect to ban excessive assignments as a third of K-12 students are behind grade level? Conversations about the value of homework and education have simmered, but the big picture is the correlation between homework and academic achievement is hard to measure, according to Stanford experts. Younger students, there's less research showing homework improves academics, but reading for pleasure has been linked to higher achievement. How do you make people read for pleasure? It's like, I want you to read this and enjoy it. You're not enjoying it. For older students, decreasing homework loads are also
help level the field for employed students or those managing family responsibility. I have no interest in leveling the field. If you have family responsibility and you got to get a job, so what? How do you guys feel about this? What do you think?
I think the reading for pleasure, for me, when they gave us our list, if you give a wide enough list with more options and choices, then it becomes pleasure, because that's how I got to rate 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which was a much better option for me to enjoy than some of the other choices.
Right. I don't even remember that, but I remember the title. 13-year-old student said no homework assigned on the day prior, 37%. In 2020, 29%. And in 2012, 21%. The average percentage of students behind grade level right now at the end of the last year, 32% in all public schools. In the Northeast, 31%. It's pretty much the same across the board. Do you believe that 30% of the country is behind grade level?
I absolutely believe that. I think we've gotten progressively worse and worse every year.
You want to get out of the hospital faster? Hire a clown. A new study presented at the European Respiratory Society Congress has revealed some fascinating findings. It turns out that spending time with a medical clown can actually shorten a child's hospital stay. Makes sense. They aren't your average birthday clown. Medical clowns are specially trained professionals who use humor, music, and playfulness to help patients cope. The clowns use various techniques to help kids relax. They play music, sing songs, and even use something called guided imagination, helping the kids picture themselves somewhere fun and exciting and out of a hospital bed. That is great idea. It does not surprise me. Mindset means everything. Fast food chains in America. What's the number one? Well, I'll tell you the number five, Wendy's. The number four, Chick-fil-A. The number three, In-N-Out Burger. Number two, Dairy Queen. Do they serve more than ice cream?
Oh, yeah. They serve fast food type burgers, chicken, nuggets, fries.
So it sounds like you've memorized the menu.
It's basic.
Out of everything I've asked you today, that's the only thing that you really thoroughly answered. McDonald's is number one. Not a surprise. Also, Saturday Night Live host, the best one according to fans. Justin Timberlake, Alec Baldwin, you're number two. It's back this weekend.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.